try to remember what happened 22 years ago.
Nothing happened.
Mary, something did happen. That's why we have these sessions, to help you remember, so you can get better, okay?
No.
I gotta get construction crews in here by Columbus Day, so you got a guesstimate how long?
I've got four really good guys. 1 week, we're gone. That's fast. I need the job.
So the loonies are outside in the real world, and here we are with the keys to the loony bin, boys.
Might actually want to be grateful. You're about to make some decent money.
What's the catch?
Hello. Gwen.
You okay?
I want to go home.
I told her to collect up Peter. Doc. There was a lot of blood, Doc.
Billy, where does the princess live?
In the town, because she's always talking, sir.
It's gonna get ugly.
Why did you do it, Simon?
Because Mary let me, Doc. They always do.
And where do you live, Billy?
I live in your eyes. You know that. Because I see everything, sir.
You did this. Gordon, I need you to wake up.
I want to come home. I am so sorry.
And where do you live, Simon?
I live in the weak and the wounded. Doc.
Years ago now, the year it came out, 2001, I was watching the film, rented it at random, you know, back when video stores were still a thing, and parents were in the other room. I was 19 years old, watching it in the living room, all the lights were on. Last half hour of the film, I just kept looking behind me thinking someone was there. That's the impression the film has on me. It is just an hour and a half of pure, just pervasive dread that seeps through every pore in your skin, and since then it has just been kind of the barometer by which I measure all psychological horror films. So it is, I mean, it is undoubtedly just one of the best of the past 20 years, if not ever.
Hello and welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jinx, your host, and that was Brad McCarg talking about Brad Anderson's 2001 horror thriller Session 9. Mr. McCarg is a screenwriter and the programmer and host of the Telluride Horror Show Film Festival. Mr. McCarg, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, as with every episode, I'll ask, when given the opportunity to choose any horror movie at all to chat about at length, why is it that you decided to go with Session 9?
You know, there's a lot of films that I would absolutely love to just chat about at length. Pontypool is a big one. Vastly underrated horror film that has so many layers. I mean, if we didn't have a time limit, I'd probably choose that one, just because of how long we can just talk about it. I think I chose Session 9 because it's the film that I credit with introducing me to the sort of psychological horror film that I truly love. It's the sort of slow burn film that doesn't, you know, it doesn't strive to answer questions for you or tie things up into a neat bow. It's the sort of film that lets you kind of pick apart and dissect the layers to come up with a method to the madness, or the reasoning behind, you know, the actions of everything that happens within. But beyond that, it's also just super influential to me as a screenwriter, you know, air quotes, wannabe screenwriter. It has helped inform, like, it, the pacing, the style, the show don't tell, just everything about it has helped influence the way I approach psychological horror in my screenplays. So, you know, to that I owe an incredible debt of gratitude, and I can't, you know, thank it in any way. There's no better way to thank it than just talking about it at length with someone who also appreciates it.
Yeah, and I do love the movie. I remember seeing it when it first came out. When it first hit DVD, I was never lucky enough to catch it in the theater. I'm not even sure if it played anywhere remotely around me. But I got to say, even seeing it on the small screen for the first time, I mean, it is a really, really effective film, and one that gets under your skin and sort of crawls around. It leaves you with this chill after you've finished viewing it. And, you know, it's one of those rare horror movies, too, that I think it leaves you with the same impression after every viewing. You know, its power doesn't really diminish at all, I think, with repeat viewings. And that's rare, I think, for horror, not only to be that effective in the first place, but to stay that effective. And yet, what's crazy about it, I think, is that it's a movie that that seems to be a bit forgotten, I think. You know, not entirely. I mean, the people who saw it back in the day, I'm sure, still remembered. It still made an impression. And yet, it's not one of those movies that seems to be talked about nearly as much as it should be. And maybe that's just me. Do you think I'm wrong about that?
Yes and no. I feel like it was released in that time period where when people are talking about, like, excellent films or, you know, excellent, you know, if you want to categorize it, psychological horror films or slow burn thrillers or truly scary films, it was released in that time period that to me just kind of almost seems forgotten. You know, 2001, you know, yeah, there were a lot of great films that came out that year, but it just seems like most people will always err on the side of, you know, the 70s or 80s, or they'll do more recent films. But beyond that, it also strikes me as a type of film that most people forget until someone brings it up.
That makes
sense. I know that sounds kind of weird, but I've seen a lot of people that will bring up, you know, or they'll ask a question on Twitter or something like that. You know, what are your favorite horror films, or what do you think is one of the scariest horror films ever made, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll always list Session 9 because it is up there, you know, my number one favorite horror film, if not tied for number one. So I'll always mention it. And then people were like, oh, God, Session 9, I love that film. It's great. It, like, I constantly see it on lists. But I think we're also at that point now, and this kind of goes back to it being released in 2001. We're at that point now where it's like, oh, the best horror films of the past 5 years, the best horror films of the past 10 years. It came out 16 years ago. It kind of just fits in that nebulous realm that just kind of gets forgotten.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are a lot of movies like that around that era. Maybe that's just natural, you know. We grew up in the 80s. Or at least I did. I assume you grew up in the 80s too. Is that correct?
I was born in 82.
So it feels like, you know, the people who are writing about movies now or they're doing podcasts, you know, if they're sort of around our age, then the 80s is what they grew up with. It's what they knew. And the same thing with the 90s. I feel like every decade eventually gets, you know, reappraised at some point. And then, of course, because we have the new releases that are sort of, you know, still being discussed. And, you know, maybe it's just the film fans' memory is relatively short, but maybe it does only go back 5 or 10 years. So yeah, I agree. Maybe the early aughts now is that period that's, you know, maybe 5 years out from being rediscovered. But yeah, but I remember, you know, being a huge horror fan growing up in the 90s and going on into the aughts, you know, whenever a movie like Session 9 would come out, or May would come out, or say even Bubba Hotep or something like that, you know, I remember loving those films. And to me, on some level, they're still popular for horror fans in a way. Like, in the back of my mind, they're still well respected, and yet at the same time, you know, I think with those three titles, and I'm sure any number of other titles that I can't, you know, immediately call to mind, that, you know, they've kind of been, if not forgotten, then set aside for another time, I think, which is, you know, I guess I understand that. And yet at the same time too, I it kind of bums me out that Bubba Hotep can get a big special edition Blu-ray from Scream Factory, or Session 9 can get a Blu-ray release. And, you know, it sparks conversation for all of what seems like, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. And I don't know. I hope in the case of those movies and the movie that we're talking about right now, that eventually, you know, they are sort of dug up and they are sort of dusted off and reappraised and held up as, you know, being really, really great movies and classics, I think. And I just wonder how far out we are from that happening.
Yeah, it feels like with each passing year, I mean, that these films generally end up on these lists, like, you know, best horror films of whenever, that you probably haven't seen.
God, this list drives me insane.
It's like, and they're usually films like May and Session 9 and stuff like that, but you also got to look at the audience. For horror fans know Session 9. Like, that is, to me, Session 9 at this point, you know, 16 years after it came out, is the sort of film that is the trusty standby on your DVD shelf.
Oh, yeah.
That you know is always there. It's always ready when you want a good scare. But it served its purpose. It's been 16 years. It's done what it needs to do, but you know you can always count on it. For me, it's you know, if I have a friend coming over and they want to watch a horror film, generally most of my friends that that live here in Denver with me aren't, you know, big horror fans. So to me, it's like, oh, you want to watch a horror film? I've got the perfect one. And I'll turn on Session 9. And, you know, 99% of the people I show it to are like, that terrified the hell out of me.
Yeah, it's... And but what's crazy is even being a jaded horror fan, too, it has the same effect on me, you know, which is crazy because you look at it, it's not in any way a traditional horror tale, I don't think. And not in the type of story it's telling. Not, I mean, it's a tale of madness, I think, and potential, you know, potentially a haunting. And we can definitely get into that. But, you know, the way in which it's told, the way in which it's more of a character piece, you know, featuring a bunch of guys that we sort of get to know and kind of care about, and they're, you know, put in the harm's way, and but guys that I don't think you usually see in tales like this or even in movies period, I don't think. And not only that, the bulk of the movie takes place in broad daylight, and yet it still manages to be, you know, really icy and chilling and as creepy as any movie that ever took place on a dark and stormy night, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's, I was going to specifically mention the fact that the whole movie's done in daylight, save for, like, you know, one brief scene that's set at night. But your point about the characters, it's like, you know, modern day horror films, mainly, you know, I guess we kind of have to dissect, you know, divide it between like big theatrical releases and then films like, you know, The Witch or something like that. You know, those little indie films, like if Session 9 were to come out today, to me, it would be lumped into that obviously pure indie category, but
it would go straight to VOD probably.
Probably, yeah. And I mean, to me, you know, the box art sells it. You know, it's one of those rare cases where the box art is truly chilling as well. But yeah, you look at the cast, and I mean, you have the kid, Brendan Sexton III. You have, I mean, one of the greatest over actors of all time, David Caruso. You have, you know, a Scotsman is the lead. You have Josh Lucas, I believe, before he got big. Or big, air quotes. I don't even know what he's up to nowadays.
Yeah, he's an actor who I always liked, and yet at the same time, it's like he always seemed like he was maybe 5 or 10 minutes away from being an A-lister, and then that time never really came.
Yeah, I mean, he was in American Psycho.
Oh, my God. I forgot about – yeah, totally. He, yep. I think the first movie I always think of him, like, you know, when he was at the start of his career was oh, Scott Reynolds' movie, When Strangers Appear. I think that was the first time I ever saw him in a movie where I recognized, I was like, oh, this guy's really interesting. And then Session 9, of course. And then, you know, like 2 years later, he was in The Hulk. And then, you know, he kind of like...
He was in Rene Russo romantic comedy. I think he was in Sweet Home Alabama or something like that. I don't know why the hell I know that.
You're a closeted Reese Witherspoon fan. It's completely cool. No judgment whatsoever. It's fine.
But
all right, I admit freely, I kind of like that movie.
Hey, one of my favorite movies is You've Got Mail, so no judgment here. But yeah, no, it's such an interesting cast. It's like you got, you know, the older guy, the young kid, and then just a diverse mix of you know, just kind of like grizzled everyday blue collar workers thrown into this crazy real life location. All the stories that they tell in the movie are effectively true. And it basically just lets the creepiness of this giant insane asylum drive everything. You know, the characters are incredibly well fleshed out. It's just, I mean, without, you know, kind of deviating from the natural progression of this conversation, it's like there's just so much you can discuss about it, especially within the context of modern horror films. That it's like if it were to get made today, it, I think, would be the type of film that if it got released in theaters would make zero money. It would just be completely destroyed. But if it did the festival circuit, I feel like it would, you know, fit at home perfectly at Fantastic Fest or Fantasia or Toronto After Dark or hell, Telluride Horror Show. Shameless plug.
No, I think you're right. I think it would be the darling, definitely, much in the same way that, you know, say The Witch or It Follows was for its years. It feels like, yeah, I wonder if it wasn't a little bit ahead of its time for the type of thing that it was doing.
I'd say yes. It's the type of film, you know, it you know, like looking at the Wikipedia page and all that, you know, it's considered a cult film and all that. I don't see it as a cult film. I see it as just a film that has managed to withstand the test of time. And to your point, it was a little bit ahead of its time. And like I said, I can see it fit perfectly with The Witch and Black Coat's Daughter and all those films that are coming out now to great acclaim. And I feel like this is the sort of film that would be that festival darling, because it's just so unique and so well made, despite the fact that it's so small. So it definitely didn't get its due back in 2001. You know, it looks like the box office was just like 1.6 million.
Even that much. That's even kind of surprising to me.
Yeah, apparently, according to this, it actually did premiere at Fantasia and was released in theaters in August and lasted 2 months in the theaters.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that.
And it only made $378,000 in the theaters, which, again, is a testament to what you're saying about how it was definitely ahead of its time. But, I mean, you look at the theater gross, it would completely die in the theaters today as well, I think.
Oh, yeah. It's not a movie that will ever be released or would have ever been released on 2000 screens, I don't think, which is a shame because you know, all the people that I know of who have watched this movie, I haven't encountered that many negative reviews. In fact, I haven't really encountered that many reviews that were anything less than, wow, this movie is really effective. It's really terrifying. It's, you know, I challenge any listener out there to, you know, point out a negative review or, you know, to point out a section of fandom that, you know, maybe actively dislikes the movie. Maybe I'm completely wrong about that. I'm ignorant of it. But it feels like a movie that's very well respected. So even, again, for it being relatively, you know, unheard of these days, you know, for not being talked about that much. So I don't know. Maybe I'm harping on that so much because my fingers were crossed when that damn Blu-ray came out that people would, you know, really start talking about it at length. But, you know, it really was. I think probably the best chance that it had was it Rue Morgue that put the movie on its cover in advance of the Blu-ray release? And I was like, you know, it was kind of a, you know, loving look back at the movie. I think it was maybe for the 15th anniversary. And it's like, okay, so now is the time when the movie is really going to get reappraised and it's going to be talked about a great deal. And it just kind of, you know, nothing happened. And I don't even know what I want out of that. You know, I just, you know, I listen to a number of podcasts myself. I visit a number of horror sites daily. You know, I pick up every horror mag I can get my mitts on, you know, and you can see when some of those older movies sort of, you know, are brought back into the public consciousness, or at least, you know, for horror fans anyway. And yeah, Session 9, it feels like it, not only did it miss out back in 2001, but it kind of missed the train again, I think, you know, even recently. And it's not to the movie's fault at all, I don't think. It's just, I think it'll forever remain in that, you know, weird sort of nebulous area where people who have seen it like it a great deal. And yet there's, to me, there will always be this bigger group out there that would love the movie if only they knew to find it, you know?
I think we're about 10 years away from that. Because I think, to kind of go back to that point about how it's in that nebulous area, people seem so, I don't want to say obsessed, but more focused on either nostalgia or modernity. So we've got, and I think, that, I mean, this is just kind of a pet peeve of mine. It's like, you know, I collect Mondo posters. I got a bunch hung up in my apartment. And the majority of them that come out now are either yet another Halloween poster, yet another The Thing poster, which I'm all about because most of The Thing posters are amazing, or they're for brand new films. And I'm just like, well, when are we going to get a Session 9 one? When are we going to get a Dog Soldiers one? When are we going to get a Ravenous one? These films were now so small that I don't think they're really going to get their due until they become firmly ensconced in, you know, way back when, back in my day, type nostalgia for us. And it's a damn shame, but at the same time, I do know that the film among horror fans is so incredibly well regarded that you know, it's getting its due, but it's getting it very subtly and at random points. So we just have to be patient, I think, or I hope.
Yeah, same here. I do love it overall. But I guess, you know, looking at the movie itself, you know, watching it again, I hadn't seen it in a few years, and watching it with every new viewing, I feel like it's kind of like the first time that I'm seeing the movie so far as its effect on me. You know, like I said, its power never quite dims for me, which is great. But, you know, looking at the story, I feel like I have a different opinion on what is going on with every viewing. You know, I remember when I first watched it back in 2001, I was fairly certain that I was seeing a movie that was only about mental illness. And then, you know, I you know, revisited it a few years later, and I felt like I was certain that something supernatural was afoot, you know. And it seems like with every subsequent viewing, I go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I wanted to ask, what is your take on the movie and what's happening? What are the events telling us? Is it a movie about a man who's broken mentally and everything that happens in the movie stems solely from that? Or do you think it is a movie that...
I definitely don't think anything is supernatural in the film. To me, the alternates of Mary are there to serve as what's the word I'm looking for? Not representation of Gordon's breakdown, but rather a how do I describe it? To me, Simon represents that moment when someone just snaps. So allegedly, the film was inspired by a murder that took place where a guy goes home from work, kills his wife, cuts out her organs, like puts him on a stake in the backyard, and all this after she accidentally burned his dinner. And, you know, that's obviously paralleled in the film. You know, early on, he goes home, the pot of boiling water is spilled on him, and then everything just kind of continues. And you see him, you know, obviously the breakdown, he's not actually talking to his wife. He breaks the phone at the end and he's seen talking on it. There's, you know, all these talks of like, okay, is Simon an alternate personality? What is he? Does he live in the building? It's like, no, I don't see him as living in the building. I see him as basically that representation, the metaphorical representation that it could be dormant in everyone. It is that thing that makes you snap and basically makes you, you know, with deference to mental illness, you know, go crazy or anything like that. But I think that's confirmed by the fact that Gordon is also hearing Simon. If Simon was merely an alternate of Mary, then logically, you know, however loose you want to use that term, Gordon would not be hearing Simon.
Right.
But there's also the moment where Simon is explaining to the doctor what he did. Basically, you know, she fell on the knife and then he showed up and he told her to kill the parents. This is paralleled by Simon showing up when the water is spilled on Gordon and he ends up killing his wife and his baby and his dog. So in that roundabout sort of explanation, you know, it is definitely about mental illness to the extent at which it's supposed to truly represent schizophrenia, dissociative identity disorder. I don't really know. I don't think it's as important as just the underlying nature of the character of Simon and the building itself as metaphor for that. For the moment when things you just lose control of everything. roundabout way of saying all that.
Okay, but you definitely don't feel as though anything supernatural is going on.
No, not at all.
Okay, that's how I felt on first viewing, but I gotta say, watching it again, you know, especially in advance of this channel, you know, I just watched it a few hours ago, actually, because we hear Simon talking to Gordon and it is absolutely the same voice, you know, in advance of, you know, I don't think Gordon ever comes into contact with the session tapes. So I do wonder, you know, if we focus solely on plot and leave theme aside, You know, plot-wise, I wonder if we don't have to consider the possibility that something supernatural is going on, or that Simon is a real entity in a way, because he is not only existing in a woman who, you know, was what, imprisoned there, you know, 30-some years previous, but, you know, also this man, this lead character, Gordon, at the very beginning, you know, he hears Simon almost the moment he steps into, you know, Danvers during that initial tour. So I wonder if we're not meant to think that that is a real thing. And yet, something I don't think I'd ever considered before this last viewing is the possibility that, you know, I think early on, was it either maybe Hank or Mike, you know, they talk about, you know, the nature of the asylum is such that, you know, when things started going south for them, they had to start releasing prisoners, you know, just out into, you know, the world. And I wonder if we're not meant to consider the possibility that maybe Gordon was a past patient. You know, he does seem to be kind of familiar with the building, even as he's walking around it for what's meant to be the first time. So, you know, if we do consider the possibility that nothing supernatural is happening, I wonder then if Simon can be explained away by Gordon having had some, you know, previous familiarity with him.
I'd say out of those arguments, the one about him being a past patient would make the most sense. But to that point, don't they mention the date that the asylum, okay, it closed 15 years ago within 1 week, according to Wikipedia. It's been a while since I've seen it too as well. So I guess there is that possibility. However, I see the tapes, because you had mentioned that Gordon never actually hears the tapes, but he can still hear Gordon, or he can still hear Simon. To me, the listening of the tapes is to give the context for Gordon's deterioration. But in addition, Mary Hobbs is first introduced to Simon at her home, not in the hospital. Simon is the one who, after she fell on the doll, pushed and prodded her to kill her family. And that is paralleled with Gordon getting the water spilled on him. It is that moment, in this case, a moment associated with physical pain, whether or not there's anything, you know, significant about that, I don't know. But it is just that moment that pushed them over the edge. And then that is where Simon came in.
I see. I guess I wonder.
So the tapes are merely just providing the context.
Sure.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. I just and again, I'm a nerd who, you know, likes to focus on stuff like this. I wonder if there's the possibility that Gordon, when I say he might have known Simon, what I really mean, I guess, is that he knew Mary as, you know, a potential, you know, fellow patient, as it were.
I don't agree with that assessment. I don't think he had any connection to the hospital. A lot of this, I think, is also, and I can't believe I didn't mention this earlier, the final line in the film. I live in the weak and the wounded.
Which is to me, one of the great, like, final lines.
Throughout the entire, yeah, it is like the final line in the film. And watching it for the first time, I was like, well, what does all this mean? What does all this mean? And then, you know, where do you live, Simon? I live in the weak and the wounded. To me, that ties everything together. It wraps it all up in a pretty bow, basically saying, I live in the people who are frail. They are fragile. They are vulnerable. Whether it means they're vulnerable to something, you know, they can be compelled to commit an evil act, or whether they're vulnerable because they're so, you know, just truly broken down, I don't know. I'd err on the side of the latter, because when we're introduced to Gordon, we find out that, you know, he's going to go broke if he doesn't get this job. He's going to have to fold the company. Things are already kind of on the rocks with Wendy, his wife, got the new kid. All that sets it up for that final line where he's broken, beaten, battered. He is weak and he is wounded. And Simon, following the water being spilled on Gordon, took that opportunity to introduce himself. And all of that, I believe, is just told contextually through the tapes as we're introduced to this character who lives in this, who was sent to this really creepy, rundown mental institution that they have found themselves in. And to me, that is enough proof for the viewpoint that I've had since, you know, I first saw the film. You know, my my opinion on what is happening has never truly changed.
Okay. So. It's such a strange sort of protagonist to give us, I think. You know, when the movie opens, I do think we're meant to feel that Gordon is kind of the hero of the piece. I mean, ultimately it becomes an ensemble pretty quickly, but, mm-hmm. you know, Gordon, I think, you know, when he's presented, he's initially kind of, you know, he seems like a nice guy, and he seems like a guy who's in, you know, kind of a tough position. You're right, he is about to lose the company. He really needs the job. He has a child who won't stop crying. You know, his wife is clearly unhappy. He's kind of this working class guy that you really kind of feel for, and that never really goes away, even though the movie throughout gives us all sorts of hints that Gordon is dangerously ill and is possibly the film's real threat. And yet, me anyway, I mean, as a viewer, I always wanted to believe that he was okay. You know, that he wasn't a threat, you know, because he seemed like a decent guy. And, you know, as a result, the ending really, really came as a shock, you know. And in hindsight, it seems kind of silly because once you know what's going on, I mean, you can watch it again. And it's like, my God, it's all right there, you know. But I think between liking Gordon, you know, especially with Peter Milan playing him, and, you know, there being these potential red herrings, you know, whether or not something might be, and again, I'm talking about first viewing here, whether there's mm-hmm. something potentially supernatural going on, or whether, you know, Phil is perhaps the real threat, you know, because of his relationship with Hank, and, you know, that he might be using this job as a cover to, you know, eliminate this guy. You know, I allowed myself to look past the likelihood that Gordon was the movie's real threat. And I was wondering, you know, the first time you saw the movie, did you at all see that coming? It seems, like I said, it seems kind of obvious in hindsight, but I just remember watching it the first time and being floored by the final 10 minutes.
You know, as you were saying all that, I was kind of like nodding my head, because the first time you watch it, you don't really pick up on all the red herrings. I mean, the obvious one is the jar of peanut butter in the tunnels, which you see at the beginning of the film when he gets out of the car with the bag of groceries. And I think the movie is done in such a way that it manages to make you forget those little things. So it's like, if you're a really astute viewer on your first viewing, you can be like, oh, there's a jar of peanut butter in there. Okay, well, it's Gordon that's in there. But then the rest of the film is basically leading you to believe that Phil is the one who is doing all of this. So you just kind of put it in the back of your mind as like, well, what the hell is going on? So I just think Anderson just did a great job of balancing the, you know, the what ifs and the who's doing what, mostly through just, you know, amazing performances and amazing tension and kind of like this twisty turvy, what the hell is going on type approach. So on first viewing, yeah, no, I definitely agree with you that, you know, you tend to miss some things, but I never really saw Gordon as this hero. I obviously saw him as the protagonist, but I never saw him as the good guy or the bad guy. I just saw him as this guy going through hell. And as a testament to Anderson's writing and direction, you really just don't know how it's going to turn out. You don't know, is he going to be the good guy? Is he going to be the bad guy? Is freaking mullet head going to be the, I can't remember his name, Jeff? Is Jeff going to be the bad guy? Is the whole thing going to end up being a dream? So I think it did a really good job of balancing that to the point where I didn't sympathize with him, but I certainly wanted resolution for him, and he did get it, albeit in the worst possible way.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, the movie only needs to be what it is, you know, it ends in the perfect possible place, and yet, you know, every time the credits hit, I always wonder what becomes of Gordon, you know, like what is the next year of that man's life? What does it look like? You know, I mean, does he become institutionalized? Does he become not unlike, you know, poor Mary Hobbs? Will he have his own, will he have his own princess and Billy, I wonder? Because Simon certainly is already there, but yeah, I feel so bad for him because he's a guy that I think he snapped and then he blocked it. He repressed everything. And I think on the surface, he was still a fairly decent guy.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you there. That's interesting, though, about what you said about what happened to him after the credits roll. I know there's been some discussion, he's part of the institution now or something like that. I don't think anything happens to him. I think once the credits roll. I don't really like to ponder the what ifs after a movie ends. But kind of related without veering off that topic too much is at the end of the film when it's kind of doing the flashbacks of what happened to all the characters, how Hank was killed and all that. You notice that he's in a fugue state. Like you said, he doesn't really know what he's doing. And throughout much of this, it also shows that he basically set up a home in Mary Hobbs' room 444. Takes all his photographs out, puts them up on the walls, and that's what Hank found, or that's what Phil found, which leads to that, the confrontation where Phil dies. It is an interesting question in a way, what did happen to him afterwards, but to me it's just like, he lost it. He killed his wife. It's pretty much just going to be a matter of whenever the cops decide to show up.
You were mentioning that finale too, and with Phil sort of discovering that, Gordon has made Mary's room or seclusion, as we find out the rooms are called, he's sort of made it his own seclusion, as it were. And, but before we're given that reveal, we have Phil standing over Hank's body. And, we're certain at this point that Phil has had something to do with that until we discover that Phil isn't really there at all. And, he's standing there telling Gordon to wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up. And
I love that scene.
Oh, it's great. And Caruso,
I'm fucking awake.
Caruso is so good in that scene, but it makes me wonder too, again, going back to the potential, supernatural versus madness debate, I always felt like, even, forgetting what the cause of the movie's events are, I always felt that Phil was just, a new symptom of Gordon's madness, But I wonder if you can't possibly consider him, potentially a ghost. For all of it, Phil seemed like a good guy and a good friend, kind of an asshole. But, I'd like to think if he were a ghost, he's still trying to help Gordon, even for all that had happened, what with Gordon killing him. But I think it's more likely that it's just simply that he's entirely in Gordon's mind. And if that's the case, do you think that makes him essentially, would that make Phil, Gordon's princess or Billy, as it were?
That actually kind of just triggered something in me, and something I've never thought about before. There is that scene where Hank, I believe, is writing down the, princess equals innocence or Billy or something like that, just trying to sort of, align character traits or whatever to each of the altars in Mary. I just, based on what you just said, I almost kind of feel like Phil is the counter to Simon. Whether or not, like you said, that could be, Gordon's version of Princess or Billy, I don't know. But I kind of see it as, throughout the film, Phil is one of the only people who's trying to see reason in a weird way. And his presence at the end in, I don't want to say it as a ghost, but more as just an hallucination, is basically telling Gordon to just snap out of it. It's like, you need to wake up and realize what the hell you just did. So maybe it's not fair to say he's the good version or anything like that. He's more the neutral, kind of like I said, the voice of reason in a weird way. That's just super interesting to think about. It puts kind of a spin on the idea of what every other character in the film represents. And I mean, there's a part where not Hank, I'm sorry, Mike is the one listening to the tapes, when Mike calls Jeff princess. And he's like, don't call me princess, dude. And Mike's like, what? I think that line and just the attempt to assign the characters in the film to one of the altars, I don't think it was as intentional. Like, I don't think there's a deeper meaning to it that could completely change the way the film is viewed. But I do think there is more there that a lot of people haven't really been giving credit to. So, yeah, I mean, you just kind of unearth this new layer to the film. But, and one last point, then I'll kind of wrap up this point as a whole. You had mentioned, we had talked about, you know, Gordon already being there. There is a theory, or Gordon, Phil serving as kind of a hallucination or a spirit or something in Gordon's mind. There is a theory that Gordon, that no one else in the film actually exists but Gordon.
What?
Yeah, it's not, I don't think it holds any real water, and I believe I only read it on like one place, but it ties back into what you said about how Gordon was a former patient who had gone back.
Huh. So would that also include like the would that include Craig McManus, you know, the Larry Fessenden character at the end, or would that include the Griggs, the guy who actually, you know, puts Gordon and his crew on the job, who's doing the initial walkthrough?
Basically, the entire film would be seen as a complete hallucination, which to me is a cop out, and I don't buy it.
Yeah, I don't think I could go that far.
But it is an interesting theory, and it was only kind of, you know, popped up into my head after I recalled what you said about Gordon returning, plus the conversation about people coming back. And hell, even the line where, what was the line where Gordon is passed out in the truck and Phil at this point, I believe, is dead. You hear his voice on the walkie, you know, come back, come back. We found the one, we found the others, or something like that.
Oh yeah,
that.
We
the
found
ones
the one
responsible. Again, this I think is one of those things that people read too much into it. I think my viewpoint, and not, you know, to say I'm right, it's just one that I firmly believe based on all the evidence in the film. But there is enough little random things in it, kind of almost like Room 237, where you can find one thing and pick up on it and be like, oh, well, it's supported by this. Yeah, well, it's refuted by this. Yeah, but it's supported by this. And you can kind of craft any number of storylines.
I never want to become that guy for Session 9.
I know, right?
Even for I will go no further than the potential supernatural aspect versus the madness aspect. You will never hear me comparing a paper tray to an erection. I cannot stand Room 237. I understand what that movie is meant to be. It's trying to show how different people, you know, view films, and how I get that. It's just insufferable.
Oh, I walked out. I can't stand that.
20 minutes. I made it 20 minutes in, and I was like, I'm done. I get what the movie's trying to do, but I cannot listen to one more word from these people.
It's a glorified YouTube video.
Yeah.
There's no effort put into it.
It's totally
no disrespect to Rodney Asher. I hope to one day I see a film that he's made that I truly love. That time is yet to come. So we'll see.
That's the only one I've given a shot to. I got to admit, I kind of want to check out his other stuff, but if only because I pray that he found more interesting subjects than that one. And what kills me is that, you know, the I wonder if I wouldn't have been as angry about that. We're diverging here a little bit, I know, but I wonder if I might not have been quite so angry at Room 237 if it hadn't been sold as a film that would dive into all of these really interesting, you know, interpretations of what the movie is meant to be. And yeah, sure, I suppose it is that, but I mean, God, it's just it. Again, I only watched the first 20 minutes. Maybe there were some really fascinating people who eventually cropped up and they had some brilliant interpretations for Kubrick's film. Maybe, but
nope.
But in that 20 minutes, it felt like hours, and I couldn't do any more.
Yeah. It is an endurance test.
Anyway, sorry.
Anyways.
yeah, so Session 9. I You know, watching it again, I don't think I'd ever considered that opening shot to be anything other than something that was kind of cool. You know, you get the shot, that iconic, you know, restraint chair sitting in the hallway, but it's upside down. And then, you know, slowly as the title comes into view, the picture sort of writes itself. And, you know, I just thought that that was an interesting way to start the movie before. But this time I was watching it and I was wondering if, you know, that opening shot isn't meant to immediately communicate the notion that things are not right in this world. You know, things are not right in the world that we're about to view this story in, you know. And I, you know, do you think I'm silly for considering that? Or do you think that it's meant to communicate that? Or even, you know, there's always that notion of upside down imagery possibly communicating some sort of, like, you know, maybe demonic influence, you know, something like that. And again, I don't want to push too hard on that, but I mean, I wonder if there's more to that very first shot than simply, hey, wouldn't it be neat if we turned the camera upside down and then just slowly flipped it around, you know?
I think it served as a good introduction, because a lot of these types of films, I want to say psychological horror films, have that sort of creepy introduction to kind of set the scene as to what you might be getting for a film. Have you seen I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House?
Yes.
Yes. So that really long, creepy-ass intro where you just hear her voice, and then I don't even remember what that opening shot was. I just remember it being scary as hell. It kind of set the mood for everything before it got into the film. That's kind of how I see the chair. It's just a really cool, creepy shot to set the scene for, yeah, this movie's going to take place in a really creepy mental institution, and this chair will make an appearance later. Plus, I think the movie would have felt weird if it just started on them in the car.
Yeah.
It needed something to kind of ease people into the actual film. And that rotating shot combined with the scratchy soundtrack, I don't even know what to call it, set it up perfectly. It was quick, it was short, it was to the point, and then boom, you're right into the movie.
Yeah, I do like, though, that restraint chair is kind of a recurring visual in a way. You know, it's... you know, when Gordon first sees it, you know, it's at the end of that hallway. It's bathed in its own sort of pool of light, you know, and it almost looks like, to me, that it's almost beckoning to him in a weird way, you know, the way he looks, you know, at it. And it made me wondering whether or not maybe the chair, you know, this empty restraint chair, it's sitting there as though it's either missing a patient, you know, that might have escaped, or it's awaiting a patient that hasn't yet been checked in. And I think in either case, I mean, that's kind of got to be Gordon, right?
Yeah, no, I can definitely agree with that theory. Whether or not that was intentional, I mean, that's why I think one of the beautiful things about Session 9, I think the best films have you guessing or trying to interpret every little minor detail as in some way relevant to the story, rather than just, hey, this would be cool, let's do this. But seeing that chair, you're right, it's, to me, like you said, it kind of beckons him, because isn't that the moment when we first hear Simon?
Yes.
Saying, hello, Gordon. To me, it's just like, that is that one step before it's like, you know, hello, Gordon, and then he's almost there. He just needs something to unleash him, and that's, you know, the pot of water on him.
Which is such a, you know, that's, is anything so weirdly innocuous, I think, in a way, ever triggered such a horrific chain of events in a horror movie than, you know, a pot of water getting dumped on somebody's leg?
Yeah. In the whole, I mean, that, just like, speaking of red herrings and, you know, that first viewing, when it spills on his leg, the scream and the reaction as it blends into the generator going off for day one, Monday or Tuesday or whatever it's listed as, is so perfect. But it's like, you look back on it, it's like, oh, well, yeah, it's obvious he killed her.
Yeah, and it's yet, like, you know, it's because it blends into the generator, you got to imagine it's almost, you know, I, if I can recall, good Lord, it's been 16 years now, but I think I always felt that that moment was, you know, just a stylistic choice. It's a horror movie. So, of course, you know, we're going to marry these two scenes together with a scream that blends into, you know, mm-hmm. this equipment running. But yeah, again, I mean, it's watching it again. It's, you know, it's one of many sort of clues that are dropped in there to I don't think to reveal what's going to happen. I think it's absolutely a second viewing sort of movie where all of those things are there to make you sort of slap your forehead and say, dear God, how did I miss that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely the type of film where, you know, second, third and fourth watchings, you start picking up on the little nuances.
Oh, absolutely. And,
yeah,
you know, watching it again, too, I got to say, in doing a little bit of research for this chat, I was bummed to find that a lot of Danvers, the location, you know, the state hospital, a lot of it has been demolished since the filming of the movie, which I get it. I understand that. I mean, you look at the place and it's obvious that it's not long for the world. And yet, you know, it's so impressive a location in the movie. It's almost a character in its own right. And plus, you know, I don't know what it is about ruined locations that make them sort of beautiful in a way. But I think in its own way, Danvers is a beautiful looking building for all of its ruin, you know? And I don't know. I just, the look of the movie, I think so much of it is, you know, just born out of the fact that it was shot in that place and it looks kind of amazing. And like I said, it makes me sad to think that most of that's just gone now.
Yeah. I remember reading a story where Brad Anderson would drive by it every day and he was like, this building is just too perfect. I want to make a movie there. And, you know, it ended up being the perfect setting. But, the way it's shaped and all that, all the stories, you know, like you said, the building itself is a character. The building, the stories associated with the building, I believe all the ones told in the movie are true. You know, the whole satanic panic type thing, just the way people acted, you know, the book of people being committed for mortified pride and stuff like that. All of that, I think, does play out as a character because all these things do, in a way, influence the events of the film. You know, it's highly unlikely that if Gordon were cleaning out an old Walmart or something like that, you know, if an old Walmart happened to have asbestos, these events probably wouldn't happen. Obviously, you know, you can get into the whole idea of, you know, it's a contained film. These events happen because they're in the building, because he found the tapes and all that jazz. But just everything about the building made it just absolutely perfect for a movie about a guy who is effectively going mad. It's kind of went off on a little bit of a tangent there.
No.
I definitely agree with you on it being just kind of almost otherworldly and the way way it does everything. And it is a shame that the whole thing was torn down. I believe it was torn down shortly after the movie was made.
Oh, wow.
And it's just it's apartment buildings now.
That's depressing. Yeah. I understand it. I get it. But I kind of want it to still exist. You know, I would love to go and visit the place, but
yeah, oh God, me too. I think it'd be one of those things where like Mondo would hold a screening of the film there.
Oh my God, how cool would that be?
It'd be a rolling road show. It'd be fucking perfect.
That would be unnerving. You imagine that massive hall where they're using the that sort of, you know, almost tractor machine. I don't know what the hell it's called to chip up the tile. But, you know, the big room where Mike is eventually killed by Gordon. You imagine, you know, just putting chairs in there and throwing up a screen and watching it in that building. That would be incredible. Of course, I mean, would you be breathing in asbestos the entire time?
Exactly. Yeah.
Might not be worth that. Or then again, you know, that could be kind of cool. Maybe you're issued goggles and a gas mask along with your ticket, you know.
Yeah.
I had a dream. But yeah, you know, talking about asbestos, you know, there is that great scene where Hank, you know, is trying to kind of creep out. Is it Jeff, you know, the younger kid, the mulleted
yep.
one? You know, and he's talking about asbestos and exactly how it works on the human body. You know, it gets in your lung and then your lung tissue sort of surrounds it as though it's a pearl. And then it acts almost like a ticking time bomb as it's growing inside of you until it's ready to go off like a bomb, you know. And just the way, again, watching it again, you know, I wonder if Hank might well be describing the madness that's sort of growing within Gordon. You know, it's sort of acting in much the same way. And I wonder if, you know, that asbestos, it is around all of those men. You know, it is potentially infecting them all. I wonder if the job were to go on for the initial, you know, 3 weeks that Phil wanted it to, you know, what each of those guys would look like at the end of, you know, all of that.
Probably far more prone to cancer.
Yeah.
I've never actually thought of that story or that, you know, the whole incubates like a pearl thing as a metaphor for what's happening to Gordon. Now that you mention it, it makes perfect sense. Plus, it also supports my theory that he is just slowly being broken and beaten down, and the madness and the violence is incubating inside of him. And then, you know, even, you know, Simon's introduction could be, boom, you're drowning your own lung fluid. That action, you know, kind of metaphor is, you know, the sudden arrival of Simon or something like that. That's interesting. I've never really even given that line much thought.
Well, I wonder, you know, too, when you think about poor Gordon and like the madness that's growing in him, the madness that does go off kind of like, you know, a bomb. There is that line on I think it is the Session 9 tape that Mike is listening to where, that's the one where we're introduced to Simon, right? I don't think he exists in any of the other sessions. But the doctor asks she asks Simon, you know, why do you do it, Simon? And Simon's response is, because they let me, Doc. They always do. They always do. And I wonder if there isn't that notion here that this illness or force that has possessed, you know, what he calls the weak and the wounded, if that seems to be laying some of the blame at the feet of those who allow that, you know, either that entity or that sort of mental illness or madness in, you know, I wonder if it's not laying some of that at their feet. And, you know, that's kind of a troubling thought. You know, of course, the character that's saying it is meant to be, you know, the movie's villain in a way, but I wonder if the movie doesn't share that point of view as well. I mean, I wonder how much we're meant to blame Gordon for what he's done. If he was in a fugue state and if he's mentally ill, then, you know, should he be forgiven for his crimes and should it be forgotten? And, you know, obviously he's going to get help or either get gunned down. Who knows, again, what happens after the events of the movie. But I wonder if the movie isn't saying to some degree that Gordon is responsible for having found himself in that place in the first place, you know?
You know, I think the they let me in line or they always let me in, they always do, or whatever it is he says. I'm paraphrasing, of course. I think is more connected to the general fragility, whatever the correct term is, of the human mind. Because to me, Session 9 is one of those films where the true villain or the true antagonist, whether or not you want to consider that the actual villain, is man. And whether that's, you know, a movie about a serial killer, or in this case, a movie about the fragileness of the human mind, which is kind of how I see it. And the him saying that, you know, they let me in, they always do, I don't think it has any real significance, just simply beyond the fact that, you know, people let me in when they're broken, when they're weak, when they're wounded. They always do. So, short story long there. You know, I've never really thought too much about that line, specifically within the context of Gordon's within the context of his actions, or rather who's to blame for his actions. To me, I just see it as contextually related to the whole idea behind the film being about the fragileness of the human mind and how susceptible humans can be to stress and pressure and all that.
I got you. Yeah. And, you know, it, thinking about Gordon too and his madness, I mean, it isn't just that he killed his wife and child. You know, it isn't just that he's the guy who eventually goes mad and, you know, kills the rest of his crew, but there is that battle within him too, to forget it all, too, to repress all of it. And I do love that moment early on when Mike is telling the story about oh God, I'm going to get this wrong, but is it satanic ritual
syndrome? Satanic ritual abuse syndrome.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, it might as well be a parallel for what's happening to Gordon in a way, you know, the notion of these memories being repressed and then eventually flooding out. Of course, you know, the hell of it is that the story that he's talking about, you know, ultimately the repressed memories are unveiled to be planted, you know, and not real at all. Whereas in Gordon's case, you know, by the end of the movie, we find that they're absolutely real, you know, or at least, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's a reading of the movie that might, you know, point to them not being real. I don't know. I haven't really thought about it, you know, in that case. I think that is probably erect paper tray talk at that point. But yeah, I don't know. But I do love that scene. And I do love, you know, the notion of everything that's repressed sort of bursting forth. I love that one scene where Mike opens the box with all of the session tapes, the Mary Hobbs tapes, and how as he's cutting that box open, that coincides with all of these really unfortunate events for all of the other crew members. You know, Gordon cuts himself and, I forget actually what happens to everyone else. Isn't it Hank breathes in asbestos or something like that? But it seems like the moment that those tapes open, it coincides with, you know, all these terrible things happening to the other members, as though, you know, almost as though it's the fault of the tapes within that box now that they've been opened up, you know. And I don't think that one has to read too much into that. I think it's just kind of a neat stylistic choice on Anderson's part to cut all of those moments in. But I do really enjoy it, too.
Yeah, I think if there were a supernatural aspect to it, like opening the box unleashed the demon of Simon or whatever, then yeah, that would be good. But yeah,
very much Pandora's audio tapes.
There you go. I pretty much just think it's just, like you said, a clever moment to realize, yeah, they're all screwed. He opens the box, gets in his eyes, cuts himself. It's the moment where bad stuff just happens. And everything is downhill from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, would you actually consider, and this might be an odd question, the actual inciting incident of the film? Would it be the water being spilled on the leg, or would it be the tapes opening?
I would, you know, the water being spilled on the leg happens at the moment that we would expect an inciting incident to happen, and yet we don't find out that that's what happened until much later. I don't think the movie, like the plot in earnest, you know, if this is a horror movie and, you know, the horror is that there is some evil that's ultimately unleashed upon these guys, you know, which is, you know, in the form of, you know, Gordon. I don't know. That's a great question, because it feels like it's the box opening, and yet it's not the box opening that really does it, is it? You know, it's Gordon. And yet, I guess it goes back to that conversation as to whether or not it's a movie about madness or something supernatural. If it's solely about madness, then yeah, I think it has to be the water being spilled on the leg, even though we're not told that that's what happened at that moment. But if it's supernatural, then yeah, I got to imagine if Simon is a real entity, then it has to be the box opening. So I don't know. How do you feel?
I definitely think it's the water being spilled on the leg. Or, I mean, hell, in a way, you can even consider the inciting incident them getting the actual job. But, of course, they got the actual job until after the water gets spilled on the leg. So, I mean, that general area, you know, getting the job, the water being spilled on the leg, which is a direct outcome of him getting the job.
Well, we kind of, I wonder if we're not meant to think that he got the job, because, you know, when he gets out of the car, he's bringing in what, like groceries, but he also has like flowers and champagne. I wonder if we're not meant to assume that that's meant to be a celebration of some sort.
I think it is. Phil even mentions it, or Gordon mentions it at the end. He said he wanted to, you know, celebrate getting the gig, or I think that was said. Or maybe I'm confusing it with another scene. But no, you're right. The flowers alone are a good indicator. You know, I definitely see it as that. And I see the box opening and the introduction to the altars not an inciting incident, but rather just the setup for what's about to happen. It is the context to the events of the film. As weird as that sounds. So obviously, you know, without listening to the tapes, we'd have no idea what the hell's going on. But those tapes slowly but surely reveal what the hell is happening to Gordon. And I believe all of it was kicked off by the pot of water.
Yeah. Yeah, so. I can't argue with that. And, you know, you mentioned the flowers too. There is that great little, again, you know, watching the movie on a second viewing, third viewing, fourth viewing. I mean, there are all these moments that make you slap your head and say, of course it's Gordon. But, you know, the flowers that he is going to take into his wife to celebrate, you know, what is it? I think on day one when Gordon seems a little out of it and he tells, is it Hank, to start hitting the poison areas, to marking them in green. Mm-hmm. And Hank corrects him and says, no, it's red. Right, Gordon, red. And Gordon just sort of, you know, waves his hand. Yeah, red, you know, red. That's what, you know, clearly red is what's meant to mark the danger areas, as it were. And there is that quick glimpse later on in the movie. I think it's Phil or Jeff who look into the back of Gordon's truck and they see the overturned flowers with the red paint sort of, you know, drowning the flowers, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's like that's yet another clue that, oh, the flowers never made it to the wife, and the red surrounding them. I mean, there is something toxic here that's happened. You know, it's just a smart little, again, all these tiny little brushstrokes, I think, that are meant to be hints. I think I love that. And I love Anderson's filmmaking, you know, at least his directing so far as this movie goes. Like he tells the story in a very deft way, I think. It's a simple story, and it's told effectively, but not with too many stylistic flourishes that I think would distract from that otherwise simple story. And yet, at the same time, there are all of these little details that he packs mm-hmm. the movie with that I think make it a much richer experience than, say, a less experienced or at least a less talented filmmaker might.
I definitely agree with you. The bit about the flowers, you know, it's one of those subtle visual cues that, like you said, on first viewing, even second viewing, you don't really put much stock in. But then, you know, they all start to kind of click in your head as you're watching. It's like, oh, that's why that's there. That's what this means. But one thing that we haven't really discussed yet is the score to the film.
Yes.
Which isn't even really a score. It's just droning notes. Like, the entire end of the film is just like a sustained note. And then it stops, and then it just starts over. And that combined with the static of the tape recorder, and I believe this was actually mentioned in the commentary, the repeated whistle from a bird.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The like, or whatever it is. I mean, you know, I obviously can't imitate it. But it appears so prevalently throughout the film, I kind of want to go back and watch it and just pay attention to that to see if there is any sort of cue there, whether it aligns with something. Because it was, if I recall correctly, it was mentioned in the commentary, so there might be significance to it, or it just might be one of those things that sticks out in your head because of how unique it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And the entire score, you're right. I mean, it's interesting. It's definitely experimental. It's not at all usual, but it I think it only serves to further drive the movie's creepiness under your skin and make it worm around a bit. You know, it's everything that's happening on screen feels wrong. You know, not just the story that's being told. I think the score plays a huge part in that, in unsettling viewers. You know, and also too, I think we got to mention at least for a moment the film's cinematography. I mean, the digital photography, I remember it was the early aughts. This was one of the first movies that I ever saw that was shot digitally. I think it was probably this and maybe something like Chuck and Buck. You know, those were the first two that came out that were, you know, bigger releases and yet shot on not consumer, but maybe even prosumer cameras. And, you know, the in Session 9's case, it's clearly not film, but it isn't trying to be film. You know, it's happy to sort of embrace the look that it has and the limitations I assume it had, you know, and sort of be its own thing. And it's kind of gorgeous in its way, I think. But it also serves to unsettle you because, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the movie is presented in the scope aspect ratio. And it has this great looking location. So it feels like a real movie, and yet it looks off as a result of its digital photography. And I don't know. I love the film's look, and I love what Anderson did with it. And it reminded me of, say, you know, what Michael Mann uses, or how he uses digital sometimes, you know, where he embraces its look instead of trying to push it to look like, you know, film. And, you know, sometimes with Mann it works, you know, like with, say, Collateral or Miami Vice, and, you know, sometimes it doesn't. Like, say, with Public Enemies and what is that terrible movie with fucking Thor?
Black Cat.
Yeah, that movie.
God, that movie.
Yeah, it looked terrible. But that's okay because the movie itself is terrible, so it's fine. God, I hate that movie. But yeah, anyway, bit of a ramble there, but I love the sort of weirdly scratchy look that the movie has because of how it was shot. And I wonder if, you know, if he'd been given, like, you know, the money to shoot the movie on 35, I'm sure it would look amazing, but I wonder if it wouldn't be quite as effective as a result.
Well, I'm reading here that it was one of the first to be shot in 24 frames per second rather than 30. I will fully admit, cop to the fact that I am not a tech person in regards to how films are shot. So, you know, what's better, what's not, you know, that's never really been my area. So I don't know if that could have in any way affected the overall feel of the film. So I'll leave that to any of the listeners who may want to chime in. but I mean, it could be something. But a lot of it could also be the fact that the whole thing was just shot in the daylight. There are, I mean, lots of things to consider, I think, that contributed to the general creepy feeling of the film. You know, most of which is just the building itself. You know, everything seems off because that building is just freaking off.
Very true.
In a way, so...
All right. Now, can I ask, before we wrap up, do you have any sort of final parting thoughts about Session 9?
Just that everyone should see it. It's, I mean, it really is, and this is the worst possible word to use for it, a magical film. Because it did something that was incredibly rare at that time, which is actually, you know, just be this incredibly dread-filled, goreless horror film that is echoed in so many amazing horror films today. Because, you know, what with the whole, what are those dumb terms people are using for elevated horror and crap like that?
I hate that term.
Yeah. Post-horror and all those dumb made up
things. Oh my God, I know, we have to talk about post-horror. I can't believe post-horror is a thing. Who wrote that article? Was it something in The Guardian, something like that?
I think it was The Guardian.
I love that the reaction to that was sort of swift and merciless, as it should have been.
I know, right? But, I mean, in a way, it's like it's the type of film that I think would just fit in so well with these films that are getting, you know, such great praise for being, like, truly well-made horror films rather than just, you know, your general throwaway gore films or something like that. You know, they focus on character, they focus on story. Plus, it is just fucking scary. I mean, 16 years later, I've seen the movie dozens upon dozens of times. It's still scary as hell.
Yeah. Yeah, I can argue that. I mean, is that scene at night, you know, you talk about the movie being shot in daylight, and the daylight scenes are incredibly creepy, and the final 10 minutes, which are, you know, in stark daylight, are incredibly unnerving and, you know, brutal in their own way, I think. But, you know, I think as a result, the one scene that's set at night is all the scarier for it. And my God, when Hank is running away from what he thinks is, you know, somebody pursuing him, and then he turns around and shines his light, and we see that figure in the darkness. That's as scary a moment in a horror movie as I can recall, you know?
Oh, definitely. Oh, that scene scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, that
is. Him running down the halls and the score and all of that, it's just, it's so perfect. God, I need to go watch that movie again.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for choosing that movie to talk about. I think it's a great movie, and it was a blast to chat about it with you. And hopefully, listeners checking this out, I hope they've watched the movie before listening to this chat. But if for whatever reason, listener, you haven't, please try and forget everything that we just talked about. Go back and and check the movie out. Or perhaps if you haven't seen the movie in quite some time, maybe give it another look. So like I said, it's a great movie, and it definitely needs more eyes on it. So now, can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can we keep an eye out for from you in the future?
You can find me on Twitter at Brad McCarg. I'll let you guys figure out how to spell that. And And if you guys make it out to the Telluride Horror Show this year, I'm the big bearded fellow introducing about half the films, or I'm drunk. So one of the if you make it, come say hi, and we'll grab a beer together and talk movies.
Very cool. All right. Well, thanks again. And thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, rate and review us on iTunes. Tell your friends about us and yell at us on Facebook and Twitter. That's at Screamatix, and I am at Jinx1981. Until next time, folks, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Till someone chokes you with a chain.
Chokes you with a chain.
Chokes you with a chain.